Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic for the hour is rising tides. Is the Bay Area prepared for rising sea levels? As the summer fog rolls in, global warming may be the last thing on our minds. But signs of climate change are all around us, especially in the San Francisco Bay, where the sea level is steadily rising. Scientists project that sea levels may rise by as much as 4.5 feet by the end of this century. A study from the Oakland-based Pacific Institute, published earlier this year, warns that these rising tides will threaten thousands of Bay Area residents all along the peninsula, from downtown San Francisco to SFO and Oakland's airport, and southward to Palo Alto. As the Bay's waters encroach, what kind of impact can we expect? How can we reduce the region's vulnerability? And who is most vulnerable? Is there anything that can be done to thwart the rise in sea levels, or is this strictly a matter of getting out of the water's way? And what can we as individuals do to do our part? And how can we talk about this in a way that makes sense to all of us when we try to incorporate all the science involved? So joining me tonight are some local experts on climate change. We have Matthew Heberger. He is researcher at the nonprofit Pacific Institute in Oakland. For the last 13 years, Matt has worked on water issues, both here and in Washington, and also abroad as a water and sanitation educator in West Africa. He was first author of the report Impacts of Sea Level Rise in California, which came out earlier this year. By phone, we have Will Travis. He's executive director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, a state agency that regulates use and access around the bay. The BCDC recently hosted an international design competition for ideas on how to respond to sea level rise in San Francisco Bay. And later in the program, we'll hear from one of the winners of that competition, the Rising Tides Competition, Lee Stickles. She's a San Francisco-based landscape architect and designer. And I want to thank all my guests for joining me this evening.
Great.
And as always, we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. You can do so by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And Will Travis, I want to start with you. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Joseph.
So how did we get to this point of rising sea levels?
Well, the waters of the Earth, and particularly San Francisco Bay, have been rising for some time. Over the past century, we've seen 8 inches of sea level rise in San Francisco Bay. We have the good fortune of having the oldest continuously operating tide gauge in America at the Golden Gate. So we have 154 years of data showing that the waters have been slowly rising.
And so 8 inches over the last century, and as I read in my introduction, 4.5 feet expected by the end of this century.
That's right.
That's quite a jump.
It's quite a jump. The acceleration is being caused by sea level rise and to some degree by the melting of glaciers. The expectation is that we'll have 16 inches of sea level rise by mid-century. Now, going from 8 inches a century to 16 inches in half a century to 55 inches in a century shows the rapid acceleration.
And how is this happening? What are the models, the scientific models that explain why this is happening?
Well, it is from the simple thermal expansion of the water that covers 70% of the Earth. Some of it is from melt-off of glaciers, but for the most part, it's simply by through thermal expansion, the Earth's getting warmer.
And this is what's connected to what we always have understood as to be the effects of climate change.
Exactly.
Okay, so the Earth's temperature is rising, the water temperature is also rising, and the seas are expanding.
Exactly.
And how does one decide or calculate that the amount of sea level rise is going to be approximately 4.5 feet? What kinds of models is this based on?
Well, the information we're using and the 16 inches and 55 inches is by no means settled. It is what most state agencies are using in California, and it is based on the IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their consensus numbers, adjusted by a guy in Germany named Ramsdorf, who did some additional analysis. it is interesting that every time the scientists get together to try to reach consensus as to what the levels of rise are, they are always higher than the last levels. And the latest IPCC numbers have a little footnote which says it does not take into account the melting of the ice sheet on Antarctica or the western Antarctica or the ice sheet on Greenland. And those could have remarkably more faster sea level rise.
How much more?
I've seen numbers as high as 6 meters. So and 55 inches is 1.4 meters. So
okay. So this is the what the projection of 4.5 feet, is that based on best case scenarios or then?
4.5 feet is based on the worst case scenario of emissions into the atmosphere. But the actual emissions in the atmosphere have been higher than the worst-case scenario baseline that they used. So it is, I think, a reasonable projection. If we in California, the United States, the entire globe can really begin to get our arms around emissions control and reducing greenhouse gases over the next half century or so, we'll begin to see some slowing and stabilization. So I think for the next century, for our planning purposes here in the Bay Region, it's a reasonable number to use. It is by no means certain.
And does this projection take into account that there might be changes in greenhouse gas emissions, either a decrease or I'm wondering, does it take into account changing behaviors or changing policies, or is this if we continue to emit at the current level?
This is if we continue to emit at the current levels, but from when the projections were done, our emissions have been higher than what the worst case was. So if we're really effective, we can hold these numbers down to less than a meter, perhaps, by the end of the century. But it would take worldwide cooperation.
Okay, we're going to get to some of the pieces of what it would take to reverse some of that in just a moment. But it sounds like this is a moving target.
It is a moving target, and I want to say right now, it cannot be reversed. We can reduce it, but we're not going to see sea levels go down.
So no matter what we do from tonight forward, there's a certain inevitability here.
If we park all of our cars, turn off all the lights, and shut down all the power plants in the entire face of the earth, the levels of the water will continue to rise for at least the next half century to century or more.
So not...
We're kind of like the captain of the Titanic.
Right.
When he saw the iceberg, no matter what he did after that, it was inevitable he was going to hit it.
So not if and when, but how much.
Exactly.
Is what
that's why
we're
focusing on adaptation.
Okay. And that was Will Travis, and he's executive director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission. And I'm going to turn now to Matt Heberger, who's here in the studio with me from the Oakland-based Pacific Institute. Welcome back to our program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So I think Will did a great job of telling us what the global concern is here. I want to bring it home and say, how did we as people in the San Francisco Bay Area contribute, not only in our greenhouse gas emissions, but in our policies around bay development? How do we contribute to the risk that we're talking about?
Well, if you have a chance to see Will Travis give a talk on sea level rise and climate change, it's definitely worth doing. He has a couple of photos which he shows. One is San Francisco Bay before a lot of the development and a lot of the infill, which we actually developed onto the bay. And the bay is smaller than it was 100 years ago. And then you look at the photos of what it's potentially going to look like after sea level rise, and they're surprisingly similar. It's the bay actually taking back some of the fill that we've put in around the perimeter of the bay. And it's not surprising, because when you fill to build upon, you don't build it any higher than you have to.
So you try to get away with the least fill as possible?
Well, we recognized early on that this was an undesirable thing, and that preserving San Francisco Bay was something that we really wanted to do, which is why we had state laws that created the BCDC, which has done a wonderful job at preserving the bay.
And do the projections, and either you, Will, or Matt can answer this question, do the projections go beyond what Matt is suggesting is nature reclaiming what was filled in terms of the area of land that will be encroached by the bay's rising waters?
Well, first off, I wouldn't call it nature. This is no longer a natural process.
Okay.
Essentially, the bay we're seeing today is about a third smaller than it was when California became a state. And as Matt said, we filled a third of it. We filled it just high enough to get it above sea level. And in fact, if you're anywhere around the shoreline of the bay today and you're standing on flat land, it's about a 95% probability you're on filled land. So if the water gets high enough to go over the tip of that fill, it will simply walk its way back to the original shoreline of the bay. When we did the mapping for the area that would be possibly inundated at mid-century by 16 inches of sea level rise, and the area that would be inundated by the end of the century at 55 inches of sea level rise, a big span, but they were 84% the same. So the water just gets up, pops over the edge, and just rams back to the far edge. It'll be inundated earlier, and then later it'll be inundated deeper.
And back to you, Matt. Mm-hmm. To give our listeners a sense of what parts of the bay are going to be impacted the earliest by the sea level rise, what neighborhoods, what communities are we talking about here?
Well, in general, let me describe the impacts. I mean, what we're going to see is we're going to see an increase in coastal flooding. And also some areas which are not necessarily vulnerable to flooding, to being inundated, where you're going to see increased erosion, where you have the waves hitting higher against dunes and bluffs that are going to be eroding more quickly. When we did a statewide analysis of the sort of who and what infrastructure was going to be in harm's way, more than half of that is in San Francisco Bay, which makes sense. We have about 2,000 miles of coastline in California, about 1,000 miles in the Pacific, and another 1,000 miles inside the bay. But a lot of high-value property and a lot of neighborhoods. I live in the East Bay in Richmond, and that's one area. In Oakland, the airports, San Francisco and Oakland airports. Some areas in San Francisco, like Ocean City, Bayview, Hunters Point, down where the stadium is, mm-hmm. where the 49ers, well, maybe play for a little while longer.
Maybe that's why they want to leave.
And in the South Bay especially, places like Foster City, Union City, a lot of low-lying...
Palo Alto, Redwood City.
A lot of those places, which are actually, some of them, because of subsidence, the land is actually below sea level, and they're currently protected.
What's subsidence?
So that's when the land actually shrinks, and it gets lower. And that's happened in a lot of places as we've built upon it or farmed it. And they're protected by levees. And one of the results of our analysis was that there are, and it makes sense, there's a lot of people who live on the coast now who are living with risk. And then the number of people exposed to that risk, to flooding or to erosion, is going to increase in the future. But we're certainly not without risk at present.
And yet, I believe it was your report from the Pacific Institute that was released earlier this year that although we're talking about some high-priced property that's at risk here, that the concern is that actually low-income populations and communities of color are going to be disproportionately impacted by the sea level rise. Explain that.
Well, disasters don't discriminate, but the social and economic conditions in communities make a difference in how well those groups are able to respond to disasters. So around the state, we identified about 500,000 people that would be in the floodplain for a 100-year flood. That has a 1% chance of occurring every year. But when you're in a household that doesn't speak English as a first language, it's going to have an impact on your ability to respond to that disaster. Or if you're, for instance, a renter, you may not have taken the same steps to protect your property, to floodproof your home. Experience after some of these notable natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans was that the minority communities, communities of color, and low-income communities were less resilient, less able to respond. So you had a year after the disaster.
Less able to evacuate, I imagine, as well.
Maybe just didn't have access to a car or didn't know someone with a car or weren't listening to the radio. Studies have shown that in some particularly immigrant communities, that they're more likely to respond to community outreach via churches and schools than to just listening to public announcements over the radio, which is maybe bad news for KLW, but good news for people who work with these communities.
And going back to you, Will, so we're projecting the sea level rise by 2100, but it's not going to happen the night before the turn of the century. It's going to be a gradual process over the next several decades. What are some of the near-term impacts that we're seeing? Because I can imagine some people saying, you know, well, it's not going to happen for several more decades. It doesn't seem like we could do much to stop it right now. Why should I be worrying?
Well, maybe we should have this conversation a year from now, because the projections are that we're going to have an El Nino winter with heavy rains. Mm-hmm. And what the scientists tell us, in addition to sea level rise, the kinds of storm surge, which is what we get in the Bay Area in the winter, when we have low barometric pressure, we have heavy rains, we have the highest tides, and we have wind pushing the water far up onto the shore. Those sorts of events, really significant storm surge events that we've experienced once a century in the past, the scientists tell us, expect those 10 times as often in the future. So while we can look at this sea level rise as kind of a slowly filling bathtub, it doesn't matter if you're in an area that won't be impacted by sea level rise for perhaps 10 or 20 or 30 years, if you're going to face winter flooding every several years.
And so as it seems, it's a convergence of multiple factors that all eventually goes back to the common factor being the increase in greenhouse gas emissions.
Exactly.
And a question for both you, Matt, and Will. Do people get this, that it's not just about the greenhouse gas emissions and that there are these more immediate impacts that are coming their way? Do you think there's enough public discourse around this, or have we really been focusing too much on one note, which is, you know, drive a hybrid or bike to work or whatever other sorts of modifications people have been advocating to people's lifestyle?
Well, in anything that we build along the coast, we need to start planning right away. And I would say that I'm an engineer by training, and that we need a number to design for. You tell us what to design and we'll do it. And that the guidance is not really there yet. And there's a lot of confusion out there. We talked about these different projections and scenarios which are out there. And that kind of fuzziness is not really what engineers and architects are good at doing. So that's one aspect to it. But at the same time, there has been, I think, a lot of interest. And at the community level, we've been contacted by engineers and planners from a number of cities on the coast. Oakland, San Francisco was one of the first people to call us to get our data and ask us, you know, what they needed to be designing for. And the state as a whole right now, the governor has asked for a sort of blue ribbon panel, the National Academy of Sciences, to come together and write a set of recommendations which would apply to every community on the coast, specifically what they need to be planning for.
Will?
Well, Matt has hit it right on the head. The engineers, the architects, would love to have a clear number. They say, give us the number that we have to plan for by a certain time, and we can do it. And the problem is they are never going to get that number. There's always going to be this uncertainty. So that's why we're approaching sea level rise from the perspective of risk management. In many ways, it's analogous to seismic safety. We don't know when we're going to have an earthquake or how bad it's going to be. So you design for the maximum credible earthquake. And when we learned we lived in a region that was riddled with earthquake faults, we didn't move away. Similarly, I think building around the shoreline of the San Francisco Bay is much the same thing. We know that the water is going to rise. We just don't know exactly how fast or how far. So that's why we held this design competition, to get some ideas of how do you build around a bay that will surely get bigger.
And I want to reintroduce the program right now. You're listening to City Visions here on 91.7 KLW and KLW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the rising tides around the San Francisco Bay with our guest, Matthew Heberger. He's with the Oakland-based Pacific Institute. And by phone, we're joined by Will Travis. He's Executive Director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission. And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation with your questions and comments. You can call 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Have you heard about sea level rise before? Has it shifted your attention about climate change? Have you seen examples of sea level rise in, you know, your observations out there when you go out and watch the waters of the bay lapping against the land? 415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, Will, you brought up the Rising Tides competition. I actually want to bring in our third guest into the program at this point. But first, I want to ask Will to sketch out for us, what was the Rising Tides competition?
Well, we knew we had the problem of rising waters in the bay, and we didn't have the solution. So what we thought would be a good idea was to reach out to the broad worldwide community and say, how do we plan around a bay where it will surely get bigger? And what lessons can be learned from around the world? What ideas can be generated? We cast the net very widely. We did not put a lot of firm criteria, and we were just overjoyed. We got 130 entries from 18 nations around the world, and they are some of the most wild, wacky, fascinating, thoughtful, inspirational proposals, all stuck each onto a 20 by 30 board, and had an international jury to evaluate them. We asked the jury to find the best one and to give it a $10,000 award. They said, we can't. San Francisco Bay is too complex, and the solutions are too varied. There's a story to be told here. So they selected six winners and seven runners-up.
And we're going to go to one of those winners right now who's here in the studio with us. It's Lee Stickles, and she is a San Francisco-based landscape architect and designer. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, Lee, why don't you walk us through the project that you proposed?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I want to thank BCDC for sponsoring the competition. It's a great way of raising public awareness of this issue. In the last couple of years, sea level rise has generated significant discussion professionally within the urban design and architectural community. I actually completed this project with my partner, Wright Yang. And, you know, the way we looked at sea level rise was no one really knows or understands how fast or slow it's going to occur. And we really wanted to develop a realistic proposal that would work with existing and proposed developments and could be started right away. And really, we looked at this and said, how can we negotiate with the sea? And we decided for our generation, we need to decide what areas we need to protect and what areas need to take a natural course of change, which are areas are adaptable to sea level rise, and what this might actually look like physically. So within our proposal, the area that we looked at, we had done significant research on before. This was the industrial waterfront of San Francisco. And this basically extends from Mission Bay all the way down to Candlestick Park, with the waterfront on your west side and bordered by the highway on your east side. So this was the area that we were looking at. And what you need to really understand about this area is that this area was really influenced by economic factors, and this is how the land developed there. So the highway, the port, the Navy, and the industrial activities all formed this land. So it was really formed by economics. And what you really have along the industrial waterfront of San Francisco is an area that, you know, isn't really culturally accessible or environmentally conscious. So those have kind of been left out of the industrial waterfront. And unfortunately for a lot of the residents there, they can't actually even make it to the waterfront. So that was some of the background of our proposal. And, you know, when we looked at the proposal, we thought, you know, what areas do we need to protect and what can we let go of? So in our area, we said we can let go of this and we can actually figure out how we're going to adapt this specific area of San Francisco to sea level rise. So there was basically two components of this. One was, you know, all future developments need to be at a higher elevation. So that was the first component. And the second component was more of the ecological component. You know, how can we start to work with the lower elevations in a way that makes sense? So we basically thought of, you know, ecological networks that would be at lower elevations that would extend into higher elevations. So we basically looked at areas like Elias Creek, Yosemite Creek, and how we could start to form ecological and cultural corridors. These would be like highly programmed areas that would extend from the waterfront and then extend all the way to the east.
What would that actually look like?
Well, that would look, you know, it would start with the tidal marsh. That was, you know, originally, this, you have to remember this area is bay fill too. Originally, there was a lot of marsh in this area. So the tidal marsh is a natural barrier for sea level rise and floodplain activity. You know, it works to cleanse toxins. It's great for stormwater management. It's great to have a pervious landscape. So it's a natural buffer. So you would start with the tidal marsh, and then you would work towards, you know, grassland, upland forest. And, you know, this could be something that, for example, would extend all the way from Elias Creek in the industrial areas where there's, you know, parking and warehouses. You could start to put this system in these areas, and you could extend these systems all the way up through the residential areas, you know, where there's parks, and they would really become like corridors, ecological corridors, and cultural, because we need to bring program to these that would extend throughout the city.
So we're not talking levees or some sort of water breaks or breakers or anything like that.
We were really trying to avoid that and say, you know, instead of building up a barrier, how can we actually work with sea level rise? How can we, you know, protect ourselves, of course, you know, and that's where, why you build on higher elevations. But how can we actually start to work with sea level rise? Because if we start now, you know, we have enough time to actually solve the problem and, you know, make a positive change in some areas. You know, in some areas you can make this into an opportunity. So we were looking at it from that perspective.
And what's the actual cost of your plan?
The actual
dollar cost? Did you not have to put a budget together for this competition?
You know, actually we didn't. Thank God.
Okay, so what do you foresee then about as the cost to the current community? I mean, I imagine that the benefit, of course, would be to mitigate sea level rise. But how would the community have to adapt to what you're doing?
Well, most of our proposal was, you know, not within the residential areas itself.
Okay.
It was within the industrial landscape. So you had to remember the industrial landscape is actually, a lot of it's underutilized, a lot of it's vacant. So, you know, part of our proposal was you take the industrial landscape, you densify it, and then you have room and areas on the vacant land or the parking land where you can make it more pervious.
I see.
So you can start off with that, and you can have incentives for this. I mean, certainly you can have incentives within the government for, you know, the industrial land to be more dense. It's the lowest economic density in San Francisco. It's the lowest FAR. So certainly there's reasons for this to be denser. And then in terms of benefiting the community, I mean, this would be a great benefit because you have to remember right now the industrial eastern waterfront isn't really accessible. I mean, of course, there's lots of things planned there. There's mixed use proposals, but you know, for decades, this has been an inaccessible area of San Francisco where the public can't even get through to the street system. So in terms of benefit to the community, if you had these areas that actually were, you know, accessible culturally with highly programmed outdoor activities, cultural facilities, it would be a great place.
And Will, I can see why Lee was chosen as one of the winning proposals. Sounds like she put a lot of time into this. What was really interesting to me is when she first framed her discussion, she talked about areas of protecting and areas of letting go. Can you explain sort of how that works in proposals and other proposals to address the issues of sea level rise?
Well, I think that she stated it exactly correctly. In many ways, what we're going to be dealing with along the shoreline of San Francisco Bay is the equivalent of medical triage, We're going to have areas that we're going to decide they are simply too valuable to lose. Downtown San Francisco, Mission Bay, San Francisco and Oakland International Airport, Silicon Valley. There's simply too much investment there to lose, so we will protect them at great, great cost. There are other areas, the salt ponds in the South Bay and the North Bay that are being converted to wetlands, where we've made massive investments, where we're going to have to protect those wetlands, because wetlands are just as susceptible to sea level rise as development is. If the wetlands drown, they lose their value as intertidal areas, so they're either going to have enough sediment so that they can grow and rise over time. They're going to have to be protected by outboard levees, just the way development is, or we're going to have to provide space to allow the wetlands to move inland and upland. And we'll just retreat from the shoreline in some of those areas where we have low-value development and where we have wetlands and massive investments in wetland restoration. The third area is going to be the most difficult, and that is those areas that are low-lying that may not be developed now, but possibly could be. Do we retreat in those areas? Do we protect them? Because if they're big enough, the development, as Lee explained, can be planned so that it accommodates sea level rise. And the development itself becomes part of a vibrant ecosystem and becomes part of a coastal defensive system. There may be small areas that are not developed, but they're in between other things that are going to be protected in any event. And those are going to be the hard ones. And as Matt explained, there's 1,000 miles of shoreline around San Francisco Bay. And we're going to have to go through and make that triage decision, those triage decisions, foot by foot, yard by yard, mile by mile, community by community. And it's going to be tough.
And we're going to go back to some of those tough decisions in a moment, but we have several callers who actually want to come in on the conversation. I'll put the number out there again. It's 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And I believe we're starting with Philip from Oakland. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, and thank you for doing this program. I think I have what's maybe not the most necessarily ecological solution, but the most economical and practical solution, and that is to build a smart barrier in the zone under the Golden Gate Bridge, and it could be aesthetically designed and designed to accommodate shipping through locks and some wildlife movement through channels when the tide differential is correct, and to accommodate the delta and ocean flows simultaneously, and, you know, one could build in generation and so on, too. And this way, in one step, you're taking care of the whole bay. And, to ground this, I mean, the estimates I've seen just from the melting of Greenland alone, the projected ocean level is supposed to go up 25 feet, and the ice level of Greenland has shrunk massively in the last 10, 15 years, and we already know that we can navigate over the North Pole now instead of taking the Panama Canal in the summertime. So, I mean, it's very, we have to de-engineering these solutions and implementing them sooner than later. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Okay. And Matt, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I have a book called When Engineers Dream, and I think it was published in 1955. The dam at the Golden Gate is one of these civil engineering mega projects that comes up every 25 years or so, and we lay it to rest, and then it comes back. And I think it's going to keep coming back. And if you go to visit the bay model up in Sausalito, the Army Corps of Engineers built that specifically to study that.
So why doesn't it ever take
root? Well, it would mean turning the San Francisco Bay from an estuary into a lake, and I think it would spell potentially ecological disaster. I'm not saying it's not worth studying again, but there are a lot of people that would be very opposed to that for a lot of good reasons.
Okay, and so there are no aspects of Philip's solution that could be stomachable, so to speak?
As a water manager and a civil engineer, I think there are some positives to it, but a lot of ecological downsides that make it less than feasible.
415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go next to Harvey in Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Joseph, and thank you to your guests for keeping us updated on this very important issue. Well, I believe that the rising oceans have already affected San Francisco, and what's happening, and you can Google this, is that the rising sea has jumped over the seawall into the sewer system, and the salt from the seawater kills the microbes that process all the sewage, and now what's happening is that a portion of the sewage dumped into the bay is unprocessed. So this has already affected San Francisco. The sewer system is built like about 100 years ago, and I think other Bay Area cities might have to go through that as well, where their sewer systems start breaking down because of rise in sea level. And also, nuclear power plants built at sea level will be flooded, and I believe that St. Louis Obispo is built at sea level, so that's not a good idea either. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Harvey, for your call. Will?
Well, Harvey's right about the sewage treatment plants. The good news is that the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission has probably been out in front of everybody in the United States on this. They've already been doing the analysis. They've already begun the retrofit. But he's right. If seawater gets in and splashes over into the sewage treatment plants, it does kill the microbes. So they're going to have to increase the height of the discharges so that that problem is dealt with in the future.
415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. And let's go next to Nick from Novato. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for doing the show. It's great. My question is, how are we going to have a guarantee that there's going to be, like, literally the political will to do this? Because I sort of feel like right now, and I guess in the past couple of years, there's been this really green sort of revolution going, and everybody's really excited, but I'm just wary that either the public or the politicians are sort of going to back off on this idea, and it's going to hit us before we get, you know, there. So I guess my question is, where is the money for this, and how is this being literally planned out right now? Like, the ideas are great, and the engineers undoubtedly can pretty much do anything, which is, I think, pretty amazing. But I'm wary, and I'm scared that there won't be the political will, the money, the, you know, the stuff set up in time until this actually has a problem. So anyway, thank you.
Thanks. And so, Will, what's been the response to Matt's report that came out in March?
Well, we have the good fortune of living in a region that is politically aware, active, and environmentally sensitive. And we, I think, here in the Bay Area, are at the forefront of dealing with some of these issues. California has been at the forefront in dealing with climate change, but it's been largely on the mitigation and the greenhouse gas reduction side. Last November, the governor issued an executive order requiring all state agencies to develop adaptation plans to deal with climate change. So I think, once again, we have the leadership here in California. We have the political will. The issue is the money, and particularly in these difficult times. But I think what we will do here in the Bay Area is what we have done so many times before. We'll provide the ideas, we'll provide the inspiration, we'll provide the innovation, and we will leverage our impact around the nation and around the world. If you look at the Obama administration and look at the people who are dealing with energy and climate change, it is amazing how many of them just 6 months ago lived in the Bay Area.
And so, again, you bring up this two-pronged approach, mitigation versus adaptation. And it sounds like we've been doing much more mitigation, or our interests have been focused much more on mitigation, and adaptation is a more recent idea. Why do you think it's taken as long for people to realize that adaptation was a necessary part of the solution?
Well, adaptation is, to some degree, people think of it as defeat. We have to focus on mitigation. We have to reduce greenhouse gases. And if we look at adaptation, it's like we're throwing up our arms. I don't view it that way at all. we need to be doing both. And on mitigation, you can do things individually, everything from what kind of car you drive to how you conduct your life to whether you change your light bulbs or not. But on adaptation, it takes communities, it takes government, it takes massive programs, particularly to deal with adaptation to sea level rise. You can't deal with that on a individual basis unless you wear shorter pants, I guess.
So actually, that was I'm glad you brought it up, because I think if we think about how to inspire our listeners to get behind this and to if they ask, well, how can I do my part? It's a lot fuzzier to get your hands on how do you work with sea level rise and adapt to that versus, you know, what you can do to decrease your own personal greenhouse gas emissions or your contribution to the problem. And so what do you think is going to be necessary to get the community level response that you need and to help people combat this sense of inevitability and powerlessness?
Well, if you look at the shoreline of San Francisco Bay, as I say, we have the good fortune. We're living in a region that's very enlightened. We have four regional agencies that are dealing with land use and transportation and air quality and bay protection, all working together on a climate strategy. But none of those four agencies has the authority to say to if somebody wants to put a new subdivision in a low-lying area, you can't do it. And, in fact, no, none of us even has the authority to say, well, if you're going to do it, at least build a levee to protect the poor people that will live there. That authority rests with 55 local governments that front on San Francisco Bay. So we can't come up with a solution for the bay that involves 54 thoughtful local governments and one that doesn't believe in the problem, because that's where the water will go. So from a local level, working with your local city council, your planning commission, acknowledging this problem and incorporating it into the updates of general plans and zoning ordinances is extraordinarily important.
So it's more about getting your the constituencies, getting their representatives to start to coordinate and work better together.
Well, and acknowledging that there's a problem.
Okay. 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com as we discuss rising sea levels here on City Visions tonight with our guests Matthew Heberger of the Pacific Institute, Will Travis of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and Lee Stickles. She's one of the winners of the BCDC's recent Rising Tide competition, and she's a San Francisco-based landscape architect and designer. 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. So Matt, I wanted to go back to you. When we're talking budgets here and costs, future costs, current costs, give us some numbers to help us understand what is the cost of inaction. And what could be? What are the costs of acting to prevent some of the problems that we've been talking about this evening?
Well, that was the entire point of the Pacific Institute's report. It was that if you don't put costs on things, it's really tough to get policymakers' attention. And we estimated that there were about a half a billion people, 500,000 people. Half a million, sorry, that would potentially be impacted by a 1% annual chance storm, so this 100-year flood. And the number of properties, we're talking about $30 billion. So just a huge price tag to that. Now, the cost of protecting also, which comes with a lot of trade-offs when you armor the coast, when you build bulkheads and levees and seawalls, like Will said, we're not going to choose to protect everywhere. But we estimated that if we did, we would need about 1,000 miles of levees and seawalls, and the total price tag of that would be $14 billion.
So not quite the $100 billion, but not small change either, especially in these current economic times. And then how about the costs? So those are mitigating measures, like levees and breaks.
That's what we would consider adaptation. When we talk about, in the climate lingo, when you're talking about mitigation, you're talking about reducing the emission of carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases. So you're talking about moving away from fossil fuels. Adaptation are those things that you can do to sort of protect yourself against the results of climate change. So even building seawalls and levees would be considered an adaptation mechanism, which is a little funny, I guess.
I see. So how about some of the more traditional adaptation type of measures of letting go and having some of the land revert back to wetlands, for example, like Lee was saying earlier? What kinds of price tags are we talking there?
Well, those are harder to put a price tag on when you talk about sort of moving out away from the risk, sort of abandoning or a phased retreat or not. What's the cost of not developing? There is an economic opportunity cost that's going to be borne by someone. So that's a little bit tougher to put a price tag on, but I think it's hugely important. And as we're planning for this, we have to remember that the ocean and the coast is a public resource, and it's something that belongs to all of us. And traditionally, our cost-benefit analyses didn't do a good job at valuing things like a nice view or recreation or ecological habitat or waterfowl habitat, things like that. It's something we need to do a better job on in the future.
Well, Matt's comments just make me wonder, do we need to also change our societal expectations about progress and what's considered good progress versus detrimental progress, especially when we come to issues of development and, you know, when someone wants to perhaps build on a coast, either as an industry or an individual who wants to develop land so that they can have that wonderful view. What's the larger conversation that needs to happen on a societal values level when it comes to issues of sea level rise?
Well, I don't see it as a either or. And I think that one of the things that was so elegant about Lee's proposal, it was an acceptance of sea level rise and how do you embrace sea level rise in community design. And if you do it appropriately, you end up with a more attractive, better, more vibrant, more ecologically sustainable plan for development that is better than the old traditional way of, well, here's where we develop and here's where we don't. So I view this as an incredible opportunity. We've been doing a lot of work with the Dutch, and they've had we decided to try to, instead of trying to figure it out ourselves, we go to the people that had hundreds of years of experience. And they're actually embracing climate change and sea level rise into their planning and have done some beautiful things. And I think we can do the same thing here in the Bay Area.
So it doesn't have to be the doom and gloom and sacrifice that often is attributed to responses to climate change.
Absolutely not. I think that this is yet another opportunity that we have here in the Bay Area. 50 years ago, we realized that business as usual would destroy San Francisco Bay. And now we're realizing that business as usual will mean that some of the most important parts of the Bay Area will be destroyed by the Bay. So we just need to take a different approach to how we plan and design along the shoreline.
Do you think there'll be any proposals that will be the line in the sand that people really don't want to cross?
Yes, we already have a proposal for Treasure Island, which is an area that is very vulnerable to sea level rise. There's another one in Redwood City, a project that has both the potential of being very detrimental, and it also has the potential of being a elegant part of an overall solution to dealing with sea level rise. And it remains to be seen which way that project will go.
And what's the reason that it might not go?
Well, it's a 1,400-acre site. It's a former salt pond. The environmental community believes that it ought to be restored to wetlands, but it's privately owned, and the developer's proposing that half of it be restored to wetlands and the other half be designed in such a way that it's resilient and sustainable to sea level rise, and that project itself would provide flood protection for low-lying areas behind it in Redwood City. So both arguments, both of them are very, very valid and have a lot of a benefit, and it's going to be up to the local government in Redwood City and ultimately to BCDC to decide what's the right course of action on that site.
But it just makes me think of other natural disasters that we are at risk for here. I think of wildfires in the Oakland Hills. And people have said, well, why do we allow people to build in those areas when time after time, these areas are burnt down and then we allow people to build again? We allow people to take out insurance policies for this. Do you see a situation, and this is all of the guests here, if you want to comment here, where we would just say, you know what, there's going to be some places that are just going to be off limits because that's just the best way to do it. And what do you expect to be the response to that?
No, you're absolutely right. And the area that should be off limits is called the state of California. It's subject to wildfires, droughts, not enough water, sea level rise, storms, erosion, earthquakes. It's a terrible, terrible place for human beings to inhabit. But it's a spectacularly beautiful place. It has a wonderful climate, and it's already filled with a lot of innovative people that are having a wonderful time here. So I think that dealing with sea level rise is much the same as dealing with all of those other areas, other issues. We attack them. We don't run from them, and I think we can do the same thing.
Matt, did you want to add something there?
Well, ultimately, I think limiting development in areas that we know are going to be at risk in coming years is by far the cheapest and most effective way than building any sort of defense. And it's also one that's going to protect human lives and the ecosystems that we care about. So I would make an argument in favor of mapping the areas that are most vulnerable and simply avoiding those, avoiding development in those areas.
How about you, Lee? Did you think of coming up with your proposal of saying, you know, we're just going to corner off some areas and just say, I mean, you did say a little bit about that, but how did you come up with that? Did you take into account how developers might react to your proposal when you came up with it?
Well, part of our proposal was actually, you know, that in the areas at higher elevations, you could actually densify everything. So you'd have much denser development, and there's nothing wrong with that. So that was part of it. And I think really what needs to happen is, you know, all around the Bay, we just need to think really sensitively and really engage the community and really come up with, you know, what areas are really important and how can we go about to do this in an effective way that really brings about an opportunity and a really positive design change.
415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go to our next caller. It's Shessa in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I guess you're aware that recently NASA predicted something of a mini ice age due to the waning of the solar electromagnetic field. Can you speak on how that throws into this formulation or interpolation?
Okay, thanks very much, Shessa, for your call.
Thank you.
Will or Matt?
I'm not aware of it.
Okay, and
well, I've seen various predictions like this in the past. And the fact is, when you look at the long-term climate records for the last 10,000 years or so, people have done that by reconstructing tree rings and looking at lake sediments, is that the temperatures have fluctuated quite a bit and that the sea levels have risen and fallen by tens of meters, but that we are currently in a period of very unprecedented warming, and that is something that we need to be very, very concerned about right now.
Okay. And we have an email, and it's from Kurt in Montclair, and he actually wants to know where he can find those the photos that you were referring to earlier, Matt, and where he can see see a recording of Will Travis's speaking on sea level rise.
I'll answer the first one, which is at our website for the Pacific Institute, which is www.pacinst.org, PACINST.org. We have maps that you can download in PDF format, or we have an interactive Google map that you can look at as well that also shows not just area that's inundated, but also infrastructure like schools and police stations and things like that.
And Will, how can people see recordings of your talks on sea level rise?
It's at www.bcdc.ca.gov. Go to climate change, and you'll find both the presentation and actually links to the Pacific Institute study. So it's one-stop shopping.
Okay. And is that where you can see the winning competitions?
Absolutely, yes.
Absolutely. Say, repeat that website.
www.bcdc.ca.gov.
Excellent. And in the last few minutes of the program, I wanted to pose the same question to all of our guests, which is, it sounds like there's an inevitability to sea level rise, that it's coming, and the question is how much, and that we need to find creative solutions to be able to mitigate that impact. And some of that might require us to do some things differently than we have been doing. If you had the ear of the top policymaker around these types of issues, what would you want to tell them are ways what they really need to know about how to get this right, but also what to avoid so that we don't get this wrong? And why don't we start with you, Lee?
Well, I personally think one important aspect is we can't generalize. We can't set up, one solution around the bay. We really have to get public involvement and public opinion and look at each area separately and differently and really sensitively. And I think, what we need to do is actually set up a framework and realize we need to get started now, but we can't have all the answers. And some of the answers are going to be up to future generations. And they're probably going to look at this aspect a little differently than we are. So I think setting up the framework is important, but knowing that we can't solve everything and just starting is what we need to do.
So we got to get started.
Got to get started.
We can't wait for all the information for the hard numbers that Matt wants,
yeah,
right?
Can't wait. Not this time.
We just got to start moving. So Matt, what do you say? How do we make sure we get this right? And what do we do to make sure we don't get it wrong?
Well, we plan for future risk based on what we've experienced in the past. And so you look at your floodplain maps, for instance, I would say all those maps are wrong. They all underestimate the risk because what we know from the past isn't going to be what we experience going forward. And probably most importantly is that we should begin planning now, not wait until catastrophe strikes, because panic almost never makes good public policy.
Okay. And Will Travis, you get the last word.
Well, I think that Lee and Matt said it better than I possibly could have. The thing that we learned from Hurricane Katrina is, well, there's two things. One, don't build below sea level. And the second was we got to figure out how to design and build in those areas that may someday be below sea level. And I think that they expressed very well how we need to go about doing that.
And who's not at the table now that needs to be there?
Well, Matt raised one of the issues, and that is the minority communities around the bay. They will be hit by the challenges of sea level rise. They least have the capability of being vocal and engaged in the political process. So I view them as the Bay Area versions of the lower Ninth Ward. We need to give those people voice before they drown and don't have a chance to speak.
And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Matthew Heberger. He's at the nonprofit Pacific Institute in Oakland. And by phone, we had Will Travis, Executive Director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission. And we're also joined here in the studio by Lee Stickles, a San Francisco-based landscape architect and designer, and one of the winners of the Rising Tides competition to look for innovative ways to respond to sea level rise in the San Francisco Bay. And I want to thank all my guests for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joseph.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, join us on Twitter, Facebook, or our new blog. Check us out at cityvisionsradio.com. We will also have links to all of the websites related to our guests this evening. Our engineer was Eric Jansen. Tonight's producer was Ann Maley. Brian Moran is our senior producer. City Visions is also produced by Maya Mirsky and Kevin O'Connell, and Daphne Humes manages our website. Brian Moran will be filling in next Monday when our topic will be the pros and cons of ballot box democracy. For my co-host, Lauren Meltzer, this is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.